sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Daniel Gordas, author of Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavinah on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom, and a slightly early Chag Sameach. With Yom Kippur, the great Jewish Day of Atonement, concluded last Wednesday night, it's time on the Jewish calendar for gratitude, relaxation, and fun. Tonight, our month of Jewish holidays continues with the beginning of Sukkot, Sukkos, the week-long celebration of the harvest. But before we hear about Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles, we have a little unfinished business to take care of from Yom Kippur, which we observed from Kol Nidre last Tuesday night through its conclusion with Ne'ilah on Wednesday night. As important and sacred as the holiday of Yom Kippur is, I'd be remiss as this Two Jewish Radio Show host if I didn't give you a little bit of Kol Nidre shtick. As beautiful and moving as the melody of Kol Nidre is, as much as it's the single piece of music that affects Jews more than any other, it's not only great cantors who have chosen to record this amazing melody, and Kol Nidre has not only been sung well, sometimes it has been sung, well, terribly. In a last ad for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and as preparation for a lighter season of joy and celebration, I must note that a couple of non-Jews have tried their vocal cords on Kol Nidre with less than stellar results. First, here is the legendary Italian pop singer Perry Como crooning Kol Nidre.
Kol Nidre. Vesole ushvue vacharome vekonome vekenose vahi.
Then there's my favorite bad Kol Nidre, pop singer Johnny Mathis of Chances Are fame, warbling Kol Nidre, sort of.
Kol Nidre.
That, for my money, is the very worst Kol Nidre I have ever heard. Although, there's a competitor, and believe it or not, he is Jewish. Yes, Neil Diamond once sang Kol Nidre in his version of the jazz singer. Yeesh, here it is.
Kol Nidre.
That was Neil Diamond's Kol Nidre on the rocks, or maybe on the ropes. Horrible. Look, I don't sing Sweet Caroline. Neil Diamond should stay away from Kol Nidre. Now that we've finished off Yom Kippur, after those selections, it's totally finished. It's time to move on through the fall Jewish festival cycle. Sukkot begins tonight. The great Thanksgiving fall festival, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, when we're commanded to remember the transitory nature of our ancestors wandering through the wilderness of Sinai, as well as the transitory nature of our own lives. In this season of the fall harvest, we eat the best of the produce of the natural world and take a week to show gratitude for the necessities of life. Food, shelter, and clothing. Following the commandments given in the Torah, we Jews are supposed to fulfill the mitzvah to build a sukkah, a temporary tabernacle, a booth or hut outdoors. It's designed to last just a week, actually 8 days, to eat in and perhaps sleep in. We decorate it with the symbols of the harvest, fruits and vegetables, and enjoy a fall festival to celebrate the goodness of the world God has given us. Enjoyment is key here. This is our Zman Simchatenu, the season of our joy, when we are literally commanded to celebrate our good fortune. It's a great lesson. Appreciating the gifts we have received and appreciating the many good things we have. Gratitude is something that few of us can maintain for long, but it's the essential source of much that is profoundly religious and profoundly good. May we each find a way to be grateful during this week dedicated to gratitude. It starts tonight, and it's traditional to invite guests to join you and eat a meal in your sukkah, an al fresco way to celebrate our harvest and God's bounty. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is a prominent Jewish intellectual who wrote what will become the standard one-volume history of the Jewish state. Daniel Gordis' new book is called Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn. It includes insights about every period of Israel's colorful existence and pre-existence. Find out much more when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
It's everything you wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's Taste of Judaism program is now in its 17th year and explores Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community. This free introductory class taught by our rabbis is immensely popular throughout southern Arizona. 6,000 students have enjoyed Taste to date, and you can too. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, Taste of Judaism brings to life Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. It'll help you rediscover your roots or simply satisfy your curiosity about Judaism. Classes are free and open to all and include Jewish snacks. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year at Splendido as well. The whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class, starting soon. It's free with no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email Mila, M-I-L-A, at tetucson.org. That's Taste of Judaism, 520-327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning. Daniel Gordis is the Senior Vice President and the Koret Distinguished Fellow at the Shalem College in Jerusalem. He's kind of a co-founder there as well. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post and Bloomberg View, the author of a number of books on Jewish thought and political currents in Israel, winner of the National Jewish Book Award. Dr. Gordis was the founding dean of the Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies at the University of Judaism. He has a new book out, Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborning. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, A Concise History, it's only 430-some pages with about another 150 pages of footnotes. concise?
It actually is concise. First of all, the pages are smaller than it looks. The next shortest book is actually about 230,000 words, which is an excellent book by an Israeli historian. This one is just slightly over half of that. So it was meant to read very easily, kind of almost like a novel, and to cover the important points in the history of the state so people can understand what the real story is. But it really actually does flow pretty quickly, and yeah, I think it is concise.
I'm teasing a little bit. It's an excellent book and a fascinating one. I want to jump into a difficult question right away. You have kind of around the middle of the book, well, actually maybe a little later, in which you're talking about Israel confronting the Holocaust, an incredible quote. I don't think I saw it before. From a writer named Chaim Hazaz, called The Sermon, about a character who says, in the midst of kind of rediscovering and confronting the Shoah, "I am opposed to Jewish history. We didn't make our own history. The Goyim made it for us." And it's a really powerful quote. How do you feel about Jewish history?
Well, I think that it's a heavy burden, and that's why I think Chaim Hazaz's story became, in many places, especially in Israel, a classic. And if you recall at the end of that quote, he says that the kids should just go out and play soccer and not study history.
Right.
But we don't really have the luxury of playing soccer and not studying history. We really need to know where we come from and why we made as a people the decisions that we made in general, and why we as a people made a decision about 150 years ago that we, like the other peoples on the earth, needed to have a country of our own. So Chaim Hazaz is right that history is a heavy burden. The Jews have often been saturated with history, that many young people, in fact, are tired of learning Jewish history. That's all well and good, and I think true. But I think we don't have the luxury of simply sidestepping it. I wrote the book in part to try to make history compelling, to make it interesting, to make it slow, but so that young people, when they have conversations about Israel, and older people, when they think about Israel, actually understand the story of how the country was created and why it was created in much greater depth.
We will talk much more with Daniel Gordas. His new book is Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn. I think we can say pretty confidently already the best one-volume history of Israel available now. When we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So your product is kosher?
Yes, the base ingredients, the propylene glycol vegetable glycerin, are both certified kosher, USP grade. It's basically the same product that's put in asthma inhalers.
Where do you get your flavorings from?
Our flavorings come from Flavor Art in Italy. It is definitely the finest flavorings in the world.
And people have a variety of choices.
Yes, they do. We've got over 500 flavors.
Now, the quality of what you provide is very important.
Yes, it is. When people come in, we first find out what kind of cigarettes they've been using, so we know the approximate level of nicotine they'll need. Then we fit them with a flavor that would be perfect for them.
How can people find out more? Where can they go?
They can do one of a couple of things. They can visit us on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com. That's all one word. Or call us on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or stream us from there, twojewishradio.com, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. You know, there's a story. Three old Jewish guys are sitting on a park bench. Suddenly, one of the old men sighs and says, "Oy." Then the second old one sighs and says louder, "Oy vey." Finally, the third old man sighs even louder and says, "Oy vey izmir." The first old man turns to the second one and says, "But enough about the presidential race." Nonetheless, since we now have less than a month until we elect a new president of the United States, we'll doggedly continue with our 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. For the first time in its history, the Jewish Week of New York endorsed a presidential candidate, saying that Hillary Clinton, the Democrat, has the ability and promise to open ourselves up to what we can accomplish as a caring society. Last week's endorsement editorial asserts that Republican candidate Donald Trump presents a danger to this country. His campaign is based on instilling fear in Americans, doubling down on divisions among us, describing virtually every aspect of society as broken, corrupt, defeated. Never before has a candidate so ill-equipped for the demands of the Oval Office in temperament, experience, character, compassion, and humility been so close to its doors, the Jewish Week of New York's editorial says about Trump. Its praise of Hillary Clinton is far more muted than its criticism of Trump. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Sameach.
And to you.
We've been talking about refugees around the world and during this period of the largest refugee crisis since World War II. Let's talk about America's response and how, whether it's living up to Jewish values, even though, of course, America not specifically a Jewish country.
Well, I think there is a core set of Judeo-Christian values based in part on what Christians refer to as the Old Testament, and we just call the Bible, or Torah. And, you know, our country was largely founded on these principles, which included the famous notion of give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be breathe free.
Written by Emma Lazarus. Right. It's on the basis of Statue of Liberty.
Right. But those ideals were part of the basic fabric of our country and of the much maligned American dream, if you will. The origin of the phrase American dream had nothing to do with a white picket fence or a fancy car in your driveway. It had to do with that, with taking people who were yearning to breathe free.
To have opportunity.
And giving them a home.
Right.
And giving them an opportunity and an education and basic health care and clean water and stuff like that. So, you know, on the one hand, logistically, for most of these refugees, at least in the Eastern Hemisphere, well, let's for the moment confine the discussion to refugees from Africa and the Middle East and all the horrible civil wars, and particularly Syria. For most of them, getting to America is logistically difficult, if not impossible. You can't walk. You can't take a small boat or a rowboat or a little sailboat.
There's no bus.
Right. From our own hemisphere, it's another question, and that raises a whole different set of issues. But nonetheless, I mean, it's sort of stunning to me that Obama has been criticized for his offer to resettle some minuscule number of Syrian refugees, like 10,000, when Europe is faced with hundreds of thousands.
Well, some people think millions. I mean,
right, but certainly 100 times more than the giant United States has been willing to accept. And, you know, going back to that article in the New York Times, it raises echoes of what did the U.S. do when faced with the crisis of Jewish refugees between 1938 and 1945, it shut its doors.
Yep.
It turned boats back filled with Jews who were going to go back to a Europe where they were going to be hunted down and killed. And, you know, I, for one, don't like to see history repeat itself. The reason we study history and try to learn the lessons that history has to teach us in such abundance is so that we don't repeat the same mistakes. And I very much fear that as a country, we're about to repeat massively the same kind of mistake that we made back then and so deeply regret today.
I hope not. I'm afraid you might very well be right, and let's see if we can help influence the course in a different direction. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week. Chag Sameach.
And a good year to you.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, one of our Shin Shinim, the representatives of Israel who have come over for the year to doing a great job teaching about Israel in our community. It's Bar Al-Kahar, who is going to tell us a little bit about Sukkot in Israel, since we're almost up to the holiday of booths.
Sure am. I just wanted to talk about how we see the holidays in Israel, because it is so very different from the United States. When you come to the United States and you see all the different holidays, Sukkot, the high holidays, Sukkot and Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, you always see it in the small community of the Jewish people, and you always see it all the Jewish people combined together, and they're all happy together, and they're all in their small community. But in Israel, the whole country is like that, and you can go from place to place, from town to town. You can see all a great fiesta and some huge party everywhere, and everybody's just talking with each other. And you know, it's a really big festival all around the country. Well, maybe not Yom Kippur, but
yeah, Yom Kippur. But Yom Kippur is unique also because even people who consider themselves chilonim, they're
exactly.
totally secular.
You can see them riding their bikes on the streets.
Yeah, they're not driving. You know,
exactly.
they're not going to
and
work.
They're all, they, there's respect amongst Jews in Israel about it.
It's pretty fascinating. So Sukkot is such an agriculturally based festival. And in America, the percentage of American Jews who are heavily involved in agriculture is not very large. Even though Israel is no longer chalutzim, you know, harvesting the desert, it That's still right. has many people much more closely tied to agriculture. You're from the north. The north is always associated with agriculture.
Yeah, I guess so. Specifically, my parents don't do agriculture, but we have a lot of agricultural fields close to us, and the whole north is kind of, well, it's a lot of agriculture. It's just a big
agriculture
place.
And high tech.
Yeah,
it's
well, high tech is a lot of it. It makes a lot of it, but there's some agriculture, and you can actually see all the people around Sukkot. They're always like really fascinated with everything, and the prices at the store are always higher, so you can know that it's Sukkot already. But it's really connected. It is a connection.
The notion of like going from festival to festival, you know, we think about that in some countries. You don't really have that in America for virtually anything, except, you know, you can see different 4th of July fireworks displays, yeah. I suppose. In your town where you grew up, how do people celebrate Sukkot?
Well, my town is kind of secular because there has a community, and we have a synagogue, and we have minyan in the mornings, but the whole majority of the town is not that religious. But in Sukkot, there's always people coming to each other's houses, and it's just a big warming community, and everybody knows everybody in the community because it's only like 3,000 people, 2,500 people. So you always come to each other's houses, and you always talk, and you always have food. Food is good for connections.
Food is great, and food on Sukkot, of course,
yeah,
is especially good.
Great.
Lots of reasons to give thanks. And, exactly. You know, it's sort of an interesting experience for you to see a country where everybody's not Jewish.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
We will talk soon. Thanks, Bar.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome John Ben Asher, our maven on Jewish education, headmaster, Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Or.
And Moadim L'Simcha, Chagim Uzmanim L'Sason.
Absolutely.
Happy holiday season. You guys have a lot of holidays to cope with in a Jewish day school in October this year.
It's wonderful, and it's a little nutty. We actually end up with 13 instructional days in the school year. But
The whole month of October.
I'm sorry, in the month of October. Yeah, that'd be a really quick school year, wouldn't it? So what do we do with that? A lot of encouragement goes into wanting our kids to go to their synagogues and participate in services, in the ritual, in the ceremony, in togetherness, maybe with their chavurah, to be doing Jewish things. So in our book, it's not really time off. It's kind of application, if you will. You know, go to school, learn to be a Jew, and now go do Jewish things and participate in Jewish life with another really significant part of your Jewish community. So it's a doing phase. And while some of us, you know, obviously without the business days to be working and without time to be teaching secular studies and so forth, it's a challenge, but there's a lot of value. And so what kids are doing off of school on the holidays completely connects and relates and enforces and supports the learning that they're doing during the month of October at school as well, and before and after. It's living Judaism.
And whether they're going to a Sukkot service at the synagogue, where they have a sukkah at home, and they invite ushpizin and regular guests into it, it's all part of that celebration. I hope that this is a great Sukkot. How do you teach harvest to kids who have never picked fruit or
cut wheat? I just always wondered.
Chances to pick fruit. We have some wonderfully flowering pomegranates on our playground, and so if you can't go into the field, you can bring the harvest to the kids. And so there are lots of opportunities for a Hebrew teacher bring in a bunch of fruits and vegetables and have a lesson with all the vocabulary, and then let's make an Israeli type salad. So there's lots of venues there. We have the moon to work with, and there's great science opportunities there and some literature opportunities there. And then of course the whole Jewish cycle of the moon and that gorgeous harvest moon, Sukkot moon that we get. There's nice teaching opportunities there too. So you don't have to be out in the farm to have a farm kind of experience.
Great way to teach. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Sukkot.
Shake that lulav.
Absolutely. And smell the etrog. We will talk next week.
Enjoy.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. So a guy builds a sukkah on his fire escape in New York City. His landlord is so irate he sues him and asks the judge to force the tenant to take away the illegal structure. In court, the judge agrees with the landlord. "I understand, sir, that you have no permit for this unauthorized structure." "That's true, Your Honor," says the guy, "but it's a religious requirement for Jews." "Well, that may very well be true, but the tabernacle structure must go. I order you to remove it within 10 days, declares Judge Feldman. Next case. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well for this next week of Sukkot and much longer. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a special selection from the Torah in honor of the holiday of Sukkot, which begins tonight and lasts for 8 days. This season is an embarrassment of holiday riches for Jews, and the Torah reading, I should more properly say readings, reflect this. Sukkot is the Jewish Thanksgiving festival, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths. We are commanded to remember the transitory nature of our ancestors wandering through the wilderness of Sinai. In this season of the fall harvest, we take a week and demonstrate gratitude. In this week's Torah reading, we receive the mitzvah to build a sukkah, a temporary tabernacle, a booth outdoors. We are supposed to spend a week sleeping in it, or at the very least, eating in it. It is a way of showing our gratitude to God and connecting us to the natural world. May it be a week in which we show gratitude not only to God, but to those around us whom we love. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Daniel Gordis, will explain which figure from Israel's history he found to be the most compelling and what surprised him in writing his new book, Israel, A Nation Reborn, A Concise History of Israel. Find out when we return here on Too Jewish in just a moment. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Nobel Prizes were announced in recent weeks, and in one way there was no surprise. Three Jews were among the Nobel laureates, continuing a trend that has seen roughly 23% of all Nobel Prizes awarded to our people, which make up less than 1% of the world's population, actually a fifth of 1%. In another way, however, there was a big surprise.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. And if your breath to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changing.
The U.S., Israeli officials, and Jewish groups reacted with outrage to a preliminary vote by UNESCO, the UN cultural agency, that denies there is a Jewish connection to the old city of Jerusalem. I kid you not. UNESCO, at the executive board meeting in Paris last week, passed the Palestinian-backed measure with 24 votes in favor, 6 against, and 26 countries abstaining. One-sided, unhelpful resolutions have been a recurring challenge at UNESCO in recent years, and the U.S. has strongly opposed these resolutions at the UNESCO Executive Board. The administration said, "We will not hesitate to use our vote at the current board meeting to oppose these resolutions." Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat said he was outraged by the vote. "It denies thousands of years of Jewish connection to Jerusalem's Western Wall. Would UNESCO vote to deny the Christian connection to the Vatican or the Muslim connection to Mecca?" he asked. The UNESCO vote claims that there is no connection between the Jewish people and the Western Wall, the Kotel. In fact, it is the UNESCO vote that has no connection to reality. True enough. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu said, "To say that Israel has no connection to the Temple Mount is like saying that China has no connection to the Great Wall of China, or Egypt has no connection to the pyramids. With this absurd decision, UNESCO has lost the modicum of legitimacy it had left. But I believe that historical truth is stronger and that truth will prevail. Today we are dealing with the truth." Israeli opposition leader Isaac Herzog, head of the Zionist Union, accused UNESCO of giving a bad name to diplomacy. "Whoever wants to rewrite history, to distort fact, to completely invent the fantasy that the Western Wall and Temple Mount have no connection to the Jewish people, is telling a terrible lie that only serves to increase hatred," he said. "On this matter, there is no disagreement among the people of Israel, and I urge UNESCO to withdraw this bizarre resolution and engage in protecting, not distorting human history." American Jewish Committee's CEO David Harris agreed, calling the resolution another attempt to undermine the very foundation of the State of Israel and the documented age-old historical Jewish connection to the land. And unlike previous resolutions, notably, not one European nation led its support this time. The UK, Germany, the Netherlands, Lithuania, and Estonia joined the US in voting against the resolution. Other European countries abstained. The ADL said that the resolution essentially expunges 3,000 years of Jewish connection to Jerusalem. Resolutions such as these poison the atmosphere and sow mistrust, making steps towards reconciliation all the more difficult, ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt said. This preliminary vote had the unintended effect of uniting Jewish groups across all sides of the political spectrum in their criticism of UNESCO. TRUA, the New York-based rabbinic human rights group, said the vote represents an offensive and anti-Semitic attempt to erase thousands of years of Jewish history. And in happier news,
take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped.
The Jewish Nobel winners this year included the expected economics winner, Oliver Hart. We have won 40% of the Nobel Prizes for economics. It's a little bit stereotypical. And in physics, where John M. Kosterlitz of Britain became the 51st Jewish Nobel Prize winner in physics, the 8th in the last 17 years, joining such previous luminaries as Albert Einstein, Niels Bohr, Richard Feynman, and Murray Gell-Mann. But that's not what people are talking about. What they are talking about is the fact that the Nobel Prize in Literature went to an American author again for the first time since 1993. That's astonishing in its own right, since apparently of late the Nobel Literature voters don't much like Americans. And it went to a Jewish author for the fifth time in the last 15 years, not a surprise. The most recent Jewish winner was Patrick Modiano of France just 2 years ago. Had the winner been Philip Roth, this Nobel Prize would have been regarded as an overdue recognition of his outstanding literary career. But the winner of the 2016 Nobel Prize for Literature was one Robert Zimmerman, born in Duluth, Minnesota, better known as Bob Dylan. And while Dylan has certainly had tremendous influence on American and international music, he is, of course, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he was the great troubadour of the 60s, incredibly influential for nearly every folk and rock singer of the era, still playing gigs today at age 75. His son Jacob Dylan, the lead singer of the Wallflowers and a solo artist himself, has been around so long that he seems antique, let alone Bob Dylan. Apropos of nothing, my dad, Cantor Baruch Kohan, co-officiated at one of Dylan's son's bar mitzvahs at his temple in Beverly Hills. He says that Dylan was stoned the whole time and wore sunglasses throughout the service. Anyway, that Bob Dylan should have won virtually any award associated with popular music makes perfect sense. And that his anthems from the 60s reshaped culture then is also true. But I thought the Nobel Prize for Literature was about writing and literature, not fame or musical influence. And what made Dylan great was not his poetry as poetry. There have always been more poetic folk and rock lyricists, many of them Jewish, Leonard Cohen, Paul Simon, and non-Jews like Joni Mitchell and John Lennon. Dylan's poems work so well because they are connected with effective music and musical effects. He's a great songwriter, not a great writer.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bums a dime in your prime. Didn't you? People called, say beware, doll, you found a fool, you thought they were old.
Okay, that's a great song. Try it as a poem and it's still good, but it's not exactly Shakespeare, Milton, or Byron. Or looking at Nobel Prize winners for literature who are poets, Dylan is not T.S. Eliot or Derek Walcott or Seamus Heaney or Wisława Szymborska. Nor is Dylan's poetry actually the same caliber of literary work as pretty much any previous Nobel Prize winners for literature. On the other hand, Dylan plays harmonica far better than any of them, and this 15th Jewish Nobel Literature laureate certainly has visited some Jewish themes.
Oh, God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no.
Of course, Dylan was also Christian for a while, which yielded blood on the tracks. Still, he did come back, and he sang Hava Nagila on the Chabad Telethon with his Jewish son-in-law, rocker Peter Himmelman. And now Bob Dylan, late of Hibbing, Minnesota, is a Nobel laureate. Wonders never cease. That's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Dr. Daniel Gordis is a senior vice president, the Koret Distinguished Fellow at the Shalem College in Jerusalem, which he helped found. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, the Bloomberg View, the author of a number of outstanding books on Jewish thought and politics in Israel, winner of the National Jewish Book Award, the founding dean of the Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies at the University of Judaism, a descendant of a great American Jewish family, now a great Israeli Jewish family. His new book is called A Concise History of a Nation Reborn, Israel. One of the really unusual aspects, I think, for English speakers is how few American Jews, for example, understand the development of Zionism. You spend some time doing that and try to make it a compelling, and I think it is a compelling and interesting story. Why do you think so many of us don't really know that history?
I think we don't know a lot about history in general these days. You know, when I speak to young people who are, for example, very concerned about the occupation, Israel's presence on the West Bank, I ask them when did it start, or how did it start, or why did it start? Many of them actually really don't know. So part of it is we just don't teach a lot of history in general, and we're not teaching a lot of Jewish history, and there's really no way to understand Israel. There's no way to be thoughtful about the issue of Israel unless we at least know what happened when. There's another reason that I think we don't talk about it a lot is that we tend to use as the milestones in the history of Israel the wars. We talk about 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973, and so forth. And then we say, and that's basically the history of Israel. But that's like saying the history of America is 1776 and the War of 1812, the Civil War, I'll leave some out, First World War, Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. Those are all important events. But do they tell us anything about what America is about? Do they tell us anything about the great ideas that are at the core of the founding of the United States? They don't. And the great arguments inside the Jewish world about the ideas that would be at the core of Israel's founding actually took place before May 14, 1948. They were expressed and written about and argued about for the decades prior to the creation of the state. So you're quite right. About, I guess, 40% of the book takes place between 1897, when Theodor Herzl launches the movement called Political Zionism, and 1948, when the state is created, because a large part of the book is not only knowing what happened, but trying to understand why it happened.
In looking at Israeli history, there are certain incidents that I think are not well remembered. The controversy, for example, over reparations. What was the most surprising kind of forgotten aspect of Israeli history that you focused on in your book? You didn't necessarily expect to focus on.
That's really a wonderful question. There were ways in which, for example, we have told the story of Israel really through the eyes of the Ashkenazim, of the European, white, reasonably well-educated immigrants that came from Europe. And there's a whole other story in Israel that, of course, many of us know is there, but I didn't really feel that, but before I started writing the book, that I really focused on it enough. And I had to really learn about the conflict and the tensions between the Jews who came from Europe and the Jews who came from North Africa, the very different attitudes that they had towards religion, the very different attitudes they had to democracy, the different attitudes that they had towards the founding fathers of Israel and so forth. So part of it was the internal divisiveness of it. Part of it, by the way, is not something that I didn't know, but, you know, kind of when you want to tell a story, you have to tell it to yourself over and over and over again to figure out exactly how you want to try to say it. And one of the sad things that, again, many of our listeners know, but sort of reviewing it again for the book struck me as being terribly sad, was just the repetitiveness of certain patterns. The suggestion of the British in 1937 that Palestine be divided into two countries, one Arab and one Jewish, the Jews accepting it and the Palestinians and the Arabs rejecting it. The vote in the United Nations in 1948, that Palestine be divided into two countries, one Arab and one Jewish, and the Jews accepting it and the Arabs rejecting it. The victory in 1967, where Israel tripled its size in six quick days, an overwhelming victory, and the Arab nations go to Khartoum and emerge from their conference and saying no recognition, no peace, no negotiations, no Israel. There's a way in which it's just so sad that here we are in 2016 and the conflict still grinds on. There are certain patterns that were simply locked into. But I would say at the same time, by the way, it was very important for me to write a book that I felt was fair, that while it pointed to many of the foibles and mistakes and perhaps even stubbornness on the side of Israel's enemies, that it also pointed to the ways in which I think that Israel has made mistakes as well. And I did a lot of work that I think was important for me, exposing me to some of the mistakes that Israel's made, both in terms of certain peace initiatives from Nasser, for example, that it probably should have taken more seriously, that it didn't. Some of the ways in which Israel's handled its domestic Arab population, it could have been done much better, needs to be done much better. So I try to make it both interesting, but also very fair.
We are approaching, and I'm sure there'll be a great deal of press about it, this Jewish year, the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, and the 50, now people are going to talk about 50 years of occupation, which is true enough. How does your book address this, and how do you think people are going to address it in this coming year, and are they going to do it ahistorically?
It's definitely going to be a big issue. I know several books that are actually coming out that are a series of essays and reflections on Israel at 50 years of occupation. I think that the big question for Israelis and then therefore for Jews around the world is going to be, are we going to settle into a position in which occupation is the default position. In other words, we just accept that we can't get out of it, and we're kind of throw up our hands in despair and say they don't really want to make a deal, and we keep trying and we're done, and time is running out? Or are we going to say, no, that even though there were only 19 years of Israel's history prior to occupation, we actually want that to be the default? I think the big question this year is going to be, what's Israel's future look like? And the book really tries to ask the big questions about Israel's future. It looks at many of the challenges that Israel faces, whether it is the ongoing war or conflict, whatever you want to call it, with her neighbors, and now Iran, which may go nuclear in a few years. Israel has a very serious demographic threat with the ultra-Orthodox inside its own borders, who are typically not involved in the job market, typically don't go to the army, typically are on government support and so forth. And they are they're a huge number. They're approaching 1 million people relatively soon. So in a country of Israel's size, that's enormous. There's an issue of Israel's internal politics with its Arab citizens. Israel faces a lot of different kinds of challenges. And I think that in a way, the arrival of a 50-year mark of occupation will probably be an opportunity or a cause not only to speak about the occupation per se, but what are the major challenges facing Israel's future? And I think that's critically important, and the book tries to address that throughout. And the last chapter, of course, is exactly about that.
You know, I've always thought that as Jews, we, in part because of our painful history, focus on the negative. We always think about what's wrong. But looking at Israel from the perspective, as you do in the conclusion of your book, of a country that no longer really faces existential threats on a daily basis, that's economically vital, that has grown tremendously, all kinds of institutions, it seems to be able to create infrastructure kind of at will. Israel's in an incredibly stronger position than it has been at any time in its history now, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, you could argue the opposite, of course. You could argue that, although it has all the things that you so correctly point to, strong economy, strong military, etc., you could point to increasing international isolation because of the conflict and because of occupation. You could point to the dangers that Israel faces if it gets too settled in occupation and so on and so forth. But I think that you're exactly right, that it's very important as we tell the story of Israel, even with whatever dissatisfactions we may have, that we look at what it's accomplished. In 1948, for example, when the country was founded, 5% of the Jews in the world lived in the Jewish state. Today, the number is Israel is by far the largest Jewish community on earth. It's eclipsed the United States a few years ago. It's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about 42-43%. The United States is a similar amount, and then the rest are spread out through France and England and a few other places. So there's been a huge absorption of immigration. It's been a huge technological success. We have revitalized a language. 150 years ago, virtually nobody on earth spoke Hebrew. Literally, virtually nobody on earth spoke Hebrew as a spoken daily language. And today, 8-something million people do it without even thinking about it. There's been a complete rebirth of Jewish creativity here in a way that Achad Ha'am, one of the great theoretical founders of Israel, hoped for but probably never imagined would be as great as it is. So there's a tremendous amount of things that have happened here that are really wonderful. And I think any book that tries to be fair to Israel needs to point to the challenges, but also needs to point to the great accomplishments and contributions as well.
One more question. History is often told as the story of individuals, and because they're the people we relate to the best. Was there one individual who emerged that you liked better, found more interesting than you expected you would as you prepared this history?
The book that I did before this was a biography of Menachem Begin. And when I started working on the Begin biography, for reasons that are not important now, somebody suggested that I do it. I was kind of surprised. I was not a huge Begin fan. I was really raised by a family of people who were very much Labor Party devotees of the party of David Ben-Gurion and so on and so forth. And when I wrote that Begin biography, I came to have a much greater appreciation of Begin. And since Begin and Ben-Gurion were kind of nemesis in a certain way, I kind of, my Ben-Gurion's stock in my own mind kind of declined a little bit when I was working on that book. But then going back to this book, was reintroduced to the sheer genius of David Ben-Gurion, without whom the country could not have been founded. And I do try to point to some of the really fascinating and quirky and really interesting people who were at the core of founding the state. And what I found is that even those people who disagree deeply with each other, very often what we have is the result of both of their visions. So, for example, Theodor Herzl wanted a political state, a political entity, a sovereign Jewish state, and his biggest rival, Ahad Ha'am, wanted a Jewish spiritual center in Israel. And which one do we have? We actually have both. And you actually couldn't have the spiritual center without the state. Menachem Begin had a certain attitude, David Ben-Gurion had a very different attitude, and they both helped to shape the state. So I think what I learned more than anything is that the people who make up this country were very often divided, but each of them left an indelible fingerprint on this country. And to understand it, you have to really know who they were and what they stood for and how their mark still remains here.
The Oslo process fails. You document how it fails and why it failed. Do you, and you know, historians are not prophets, but do you see the possibility, having done all of this research, worked so deeply in Israeli history, and working in contemporary Israel today, do you see the possibility for a peace process in anything that's going on right now?
Not in the immediate future, I would have to say. I think that, you know, and again, we're not prophets, and anything could change. There could be a meltdown somewhere in the region which forces foreign powers to get involved and put boots on the ground and to impose some kind of a solution. There could be a war in which nuclear weapons get either unveiled or actually, God forbid, used. I mean, anything is possible. But if you look at sort of the way the situation is unfolding now, ironically and sadly, the Palestinian issue is becoming less and less important in the world because the rest of the Middle East is melting down. Iraq, Iran is becoming a very big issue. Syria is literally dissolving in front of our eyes. And so in a way in which when Yasser Arafat went to the United Nations, the Palestinians were the main cause that people were aware of. People, sadly, aren't even talking about that much anymore, sadly, for the Palestinians' perspective, at least. So that's part number one. Part number two is there is still a real reticence on the part of the Palestinian street to simply say this land is held sacred and is seen as a homeland by two different peoples. And in order for those two peoples to live here, they're really going to have to split this land. The vast majority of Israelis, whether happily or unhappily, are willing to do that. There's a lot of bluster. There's a lot of saying we're not going to leave the West Bank. But Israelis aren't stupid. And they understand that if a real peace opportunity came along, A, they'd be crazy not to take it, and B, the world would force Israel to take it. Where we're at, though, is that the Palestinian street is not there. Their leaders have actually not done what everybody from Bibi Netanyahu to Yitzhak Rabin on both sides of the political aisle in Israel have done, which is to say that the other side has a right to be here, to say to their own people. Abbas never said that to the Palestinians. Arafat never said that to the Palestinians. The Palestinians are still naming squares and naming streets for suicide bombers and so forth. There's just a sad culture there, which is much more clinging to the injustices and the indignities of the past than embracing the future. And I think one of the extraordinary things about Israel that struck me in writing the book, and that I hope that I was able to communicate in the book, is that despite the Holocaust, despite the wars, despite many things that have happened to Israelis and to the Jewish people in the last century, fundamentally Zionism was a forward-looking project. Of course it understood that the past was critically important, despite what Chaim Chazal said in that story, the sermon that we talked about a little while ago. But Zionism has been fundamentally about the question of how does the Jewish people build a better future for itself. I think that when the Palestinians begin to ask that question for themselves and their children and their grandchildren, asking not how do we settle the scores of the past and right the indignities of the past, but how do we actually build a better future for our people, then we're going to have some progress. The sad thing is that I don't see that happening at any time in the very near future.
It's a sad ending, but it's a terrific book, Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn by Daniel Gordis. Where can people go to find out more?
It's online. It's on all the major booksellers. It's on Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble. It's pretty much everywhere. And I look forward to people reading it. There's also more information on my website about it, danielgordis.org, which has some of the reviews and has some excerpts and has a teacher's guide. More books to read on the subject once we're done with that. So bookstores online and in real life stores and danielgordis.org.
And it will be a standard book about Israel, I think, for quite a while. Thanks so much. I appreciate it, and hope we talk again soon.
I look forward to it. Thanks very much for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community.
Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be singer-songwriter Neshama Karlbach. She will be here in Tucson at Temple Emmanuel and in concert at the Fox Theater on Saturday, October 29th. Get your tickets now. Our playout this morning comes appropriately from the new Nobel Laureate for Literature, Bob Dylan. Believe it or not. It's his original classic, Blowin' in the Wind. My friends, Chag Sameach, a very happy beginning to the holiday of Sukkot tonight, and may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand?
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.